Good afternoon. Welcome to the Oxford Martin School. Welcome to the last of this term's lectures. And thank you very much for coming in such numbers on such a sunny day, the first we've had for some time. We've actually had a series that spanned two terms on evolving economic thought. Excuse me. And it's extremely appropriate that this is concluded today by Eric Beinhocker. Eric is director of the Thriving Institute for New Economic Thinking, and he's also a professor of public policy practice at the Blavatnik School of Government. He's a fellow in economics at Oriel and external professor at the Santa Fe Institute in addition. Before coming to Oxford, he had an 18-year career at McKinsey, where he was a partner, held leadership roles in their strategy practice, their climate change and sustainability practice, and the McKinsey Global Institute. Many of you will know him from his frequent writings in the media, and he's also the author of the well-regarded book, The Origin of Wealth. And he's going to talk to us today on the wonderful title, New Economic and Moral Foundations for the Anthropocene. So a small subject in 45 minutes. Eric.
Thank you very much, Julian, and thank you all for coming. It's a real pleasure to be closing out this excellent series on evolving economic thought that the Martin School has hosted. And I'll be building on many of the themes that were discussed by some of the other excellent speakers that have been here over the past term. I should also note that this is based on a new book coming out, hopefully next year, by myself and my co-author, Nick Hanauer. I'm going to start us off with a little quote. Someone once said that it is easier to imagine the end of the world than to imagine the end of capitalism. This is Frederick Jameson, a literary critic. And I was struck by the some real truth in this quote. Think how many Hollywood movies you've seen about the end of the world, you know, with comets or, you know, nuclear war or climate change, or how many books or novels you've read. You know, my favorite end of the world book is probably Cormac McCarthy's The Road. So we all have this visceral idea of what the end of the world looks like. But can we imagine how we'd have to change our economic system to prevent that? What kind of an economic system would we need that would be sustainable with a thriving future planet? And I thought about, why is that so hard to imagine an alternative to what we have today? And in many ways, it's because we're so immersed in it. We're so much a part of the economic system. It's, you know, it's all around us. It's in our heads. It's in our society, in our politics, that it's very hard to get outside of that and think about it. So we have to step back and think a bit more fundamentally. What is the economy? What is this system, you know, that we call the economy or capitalism or whatever name you want to give it? Well, one way to think about it is it's us. It's people. Economies are made out of people at the end of the day. But it's not just people individually. It's a set of ideas, of collective thoughts. The historian Yuval Noah Harari has a wonderful phrase. He calls them imagined orders. That societies always have a set of ideas that they organize around. And in the economy, we have a set of ideas that organize all these people, all of us, into what we call the economy. And these ideas are ultimately products of human imagination. They're all invented ideas. If you look back in history, every one of these ideas up here, property, law, productivity, value, corporations, they were all invented at some point in our history. They're not kind of laws of nature or part of the natural world. They're human inventions, human imagination. So the economy is an imagined order. But we also know it's an imagined order that has real physical impacts, that there's a feedback between the two, that what we do in our imagined order of the economy causes things to happen in the physical world. Buildings get built, cars go down, emit carbon, we dig up stuff out of the earth, we chop down trees, you know, we do things in the physical world to as a result of the ideas in this imagined order. And they're both evolving over time. And we've seen a huge evolution over a very long period of time in our imagined order, from our hunter-gatherer days to the development of agriculture to the industrial economy and to the modern system of the economy that we have today. And this in turn is fed back to our physical world and caused the shift from what geologists call the Holocene period, which is the period that humans and a lot of the other life that's on Earth today evolved in, to what geologists are now calling the Anthropocene, the age of man or age of humankind, because we have our imagined order has now had such a huge impact on our physical order, it's literally changed the planet. Now, there's a problem with this imagined order that we have today, in that it's failing to deliver on two of the biggest priorities that we have. So this is my diagram of the failure of the current system in one chart. So going up the y-axis are a set of social indicators of kind of the health of economies, and I'll show you what they are in just a moment. And on the x-axis are planetary boundaries. Some of you are probably familiar with the work by Johann Rockström and others on a safe operating space for humanity, or Kate Raworth's wonderful donut economics that tries to marry the idea that we need an economic system that is both delivering on human needs, but is also sustainable from a planetary perspective. And the size of each of these bubbles is the size of the population. And in this very nice study, they show that there's a set of social thresholds that they summarize in the y-axis, and a set of biophysical boundaries that they summarize on the x-axis. And what you see is a huge trade-off. The countries or economies in the upper right who are delivering pretty well on the social thresholds but utterly destroying our planet, crossing many physical safe operating boundaries. And on the lower left, a set of societies that are having relatively little environmental impact but are also failing to deliver on key social thresholds for a healthy society. You know, this is a trade-off that fundamentally has to be broken, because we need to be here. We need an economic system that can deliver on both. It shouldn't be a trade-off that we can either have thriving societies or a thriving planet. Now, let's go back and look inside the imagined order that got us into this situation and try to unpack it a bit and understand it a bit better. Now, I like to think of the ideas that we organize our economy around as a set of Russian dolls, nested one within the other. And so if we start with our biggest Russian doll, the economic system itself, and we look inside that, what we see is a set of ideas, economic and political ideology that informs our politics, informs our policy, shapes our public discourse and media and so on. And underneath that are a set of economic theories that have been hugely influential in shaping that ideology and politics. And if you dig into the economic theory, you find underneath that a set of behavioral theories on what human beings are like and how they behave and how they make decisions. And if you unpack into that one, you get to the little Russian doll at the bottom, you actually get into a set of ideas that come out of moral philosophy. And the way I'd categorize the system we have today is we can give labels to these things. We can call the current economic system market capitalism or some variant on that. Developed and Western countries, we've had an ideology that can be loosely called neoliberalism that has dominated much of the politics and discourse. And underneath that has been a set of economic theories historically dominated by ideas from neoclassical economics, a behavioral model rooted in what economists call homo economicus, and a moral philosophy that can be labeled maximizing utilitarianism. Now, where did these ideas come from? How did we get these ideas? Well, they didn't just come down from Moses on stone tablets. They were developed over a very long period of time, over the last several hundred years. So if we look at the smallest dolls, they really came out of a set of developments building off of work by Enlightenment philosophers in the 17th and 18th centuries, but really came out of a set of economists called the marginalist economists and later the neoclassical economists who developed their ideas in the late 19th and really through the mid 20th century. And then that fed the development of a set of political ideas and ideologies that really came into dominance again in the developed Western countries starting around the 1970s. And it really split into two broad branches, a kind of more left-wing or progressive branch
that focused really more on equity and issues of social protection, and a kind of more right-wing conservative branch that tended to focus more on issues around efficiency and growth. And then those ideologies were kind of filtered through a set of policies to different forms of organization of the economies. Economists have a sort of historical sub-branch called varieties of capitalism, and we see across the developed world different ways of organizing market capitalist economies, from a kind of, you know, more progressive, more state-heavy capitalism, say in Sweden or, you know, the other Nordic countries, to a more conservative or less state form, a la the US. But these kind of varieties or models came into geopolitical dominance through the 80s through 2010s. Now, if we look at where most of our debates have been, there's been this kind of big trade-off, a set of, you know, economic and political debates between these two branches. More state, less state, what's legitimate to intervene in markets, you know, where do markets deliver better outcomes? Do we prioritize social equity and equality, or do we prioritize efficiency, growth, productivity? You know, in a very kind of high-level way, that's been kind of the sandbox that we've been playing in, the set of debates that we've been having. And they've been very intense fights, you know, very intense debates, and we're still having them today here in Britain, in the US where I come from, and in lots of other countries. But the problem is, if you go back to that first chart that I showed you, the failure in one chart, both of these branches don't lead to a good end. Both of these branches are driving our planet over the planetary safe boundaries and into what scientists are increasingly calling the sixth mass extinction. So what I'm going to argue in the rest of this talk is that we need to bring the fight back down here. We need to go back down deeper into the system and rethink things a bit more from first principles to understand how we might start to see our way out of this mess. Now, I'm also going to argue that this current imagined order that we have is really not built on sound foundations. It's built on sand, one could say. That the moral foundations are pretty shaky from a kind of philosophical and behavioral perspective. The behavioral model, I will even more strongly say, is really pseudoscience. It's not real science. And likewise, the ideologies have really developed as stories to justify power and privilege. You know, they claim a scientific basis, but when you really get under them, they're really ways of preserving the status quo and power and privilege. So, starting with our littlest doll down at the moral foundations, we saw a huge shift in moral philosophy during the Enlightenment and into the neoclassical economic period, from an idea that virtue is good to what could crudely be called greed is good. So before Hobbes and Bentham, there were lots of philosophical battles and discussions about what it meant to be good, but there were some core ideas that there was something in human nature about tensions between the desire to be good and temptations to behave badly. And to follow a moral life, you had to follow the golden rule, treat other people as you want to be treated yourself, and somehow kind of restrain or curb your worst instincts or appetites. And there were also notions that morality was somehow part of character, a way of living or thinking or behaving, a la Aristotle, and that also morality was expressed through rules and norms that people were supposed to follow, a la Kant. So again, this is potted hundreds of years of moral philosophy in one set of bullet points. So I apologize to any real moral philosophers in the room, but you'll see my point. But then Hobbes and Bentham came around and created quite a revolution in our thinking in this. They really turned this logic on its head. And again, very crudely, they saw human nature as a trade-off between pleasure and pain, that humans are essentially hedonic, that they seek pleasure and avoid pain. And that this was neither good nor bad, but this was just part of how we are, how we're wired. But what matters was the consequences of our actions for the pleasure and pain of others. So if we're doing something that's causing plainer pleasure, that defined a moral outcome. And so then the objective was moral outcomes that maximize the most pleasure and minimize the most pain for the most people. This is kind of the basic utilitarian principle, at least the Benthamite version of it. and that things like characters, intention, rules, etc., don't really matter so much as the consequences or consequentialism of these actions. And this, you know, created a major branch of philosophy that's still alive and well today. That philosophy then trickled into economics in a way that I would argue has been quite damaging. So economists then kind of boiled this down into a simplistic model that humans are self-regarding pleasure maximizers and utility calculators and rational decision makers. And this really started around the time of the marginalist economists. And part of their interest and reason for adopting this philosophical stance was because they wanted to turn it into math. And they needed something very simple. The math they had at the time was fairly crude, and they needed something very, very simple that they could fit into their mathematical structure. So this quote from Edgeworth basically says that this conception of man as a pleasure machine may justify and facilitate the employment of mechanical terms and mathematical reasoning in social science. Likewise, they also like the fact that you could just view people as individuals and not have to consider their collective behavior, because again, they didn't have the math at the time to deal with things like collective behavior. So we have this quote from Bentham basically arguing that the idea of community is a fictitious body, that we're only composed of individuals, even if we sometimes, you know, think we're in a society. And you go straight from Bentham's philosophy to Margaret Thatcher's famous quote, "There's no such thing as society," a couple of hundred years later. Now, Steven Pinker has a wonderful phrase. He called some of his earlier philosophical reasoning armchair anthropology or armchair psychology. And the reason is, these as smart as people like Bentham and Hobbes and Edgeworth were, the way they came up with these ideas was they essentially sat in an armchair, you know, with a drink in their hand, whatever it was, a you know, glass of whiskey or tea or whatever, and said, "I think human beings are pleasure machines. Yes, that's human nature. We seek pleasure and we avoid pain." And, you know, write that down and develop a philosophy on it. They didn't have any data. They didn't have any empirical basis. They didn't run any experiments. They didn't do any large-scale studies. They just thought this stuff up and tried to reason from first principles in their own heads. Thus, the phrase armchair anthropology. Now, this armchair anthropology about human nature, though, led through economics to the idea that not only is greed good, but greed creates prosperity. Now, most people, if you ask where did this idea come from, would say, well, it's Adam Smith. Adam Smith and the invisible hand, right? Wrong. Adam Smith actually believed entirely the opposite. And the invisible hand is one of the more misinterpreted bits of economic text out there. We can go back to that in the Q&A if anyone's interested. But Smith actually held quite opposite views to the sort of greed is good and greed creates prosperity. In fact, he wrote a whole book on it, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was really a testament to human empathy and sympathy and other regarding feelings and emotions. The actual idea that self-interest and greed creates prosperity comes from a different set of economists, really the marginalists, the folks who took that idea of the maximizing pleasure-seeking individual, turned that idea into a mathematical set of concepts called utility, also created the idea that the objective in society is to maximize the sum of individual utilities, and this notion of the Pareto optimal, which everyone learns in Econ 101, that the maximum social outcome is one where everyone maximizes their utility without forcing anybody to do anything they don't want to do. This all kind of trundled on to developments in the 20th century, most notably Ken Arrow and Gerard Debreu, who showed mathematically that under a certain set of conditions, that if you have individuals like this in free markets, you get this wonderful outcome of the Pareto optimal state nearly automatically. And so this then led to a sort of broad set of ideas that selfish utility maximizing plus free markets leads to a pretty good state of things, freedom and prosperity. Who could not want that? Now, this then led to a further set of ideas about what kind of a system the economy is. And again, you know, the motivations for this were not bad ones. So Leon Walras, one of the founders of general equilibrium theory, wanted to make economics a more mathematical science, which was a good objective. You wanted to make it more of a science as opposed to the philosophy of Adam Smith and the classical economist. But he had a bad case of physics envy. And he actually, when you look into the history of this, he took a specific book. A guy named Quanso wrote this book on the physics of static systems. And he literally copied equations out of it and developed his equations for equilibrium theory. And he was quite explicit about it. He was basically substituting words and concepts in the equation. So he says, you know, scarcity are here in given scientific meaning, like the word velocity in mechanics and the word heat in physics. So it was an act of kind of metaphorical and mathematical borrowing. And he got out of that a set of ideas that have carried on through economics right to the modern day, still taught here in Oxford in PPE and other courses, that economic systems are equilibrium systems, that they're optimizing, that they're essentially static and change comes from the outside. Also that, again, this idea there's no such thing as society, that it's basically a summation of individuals. And then also that it's a separable system. It's somehow closed and you can separate it from other systems like the physical environment or social and political systems. And again, this was, you know, these people were not dumb. They knew that these were hugely simplifying assumptions, but given the math they had at the time, that's what they felt they had to make it more like physics. And this then led to, you know, the neoclassical theory that dominated really up until the 1970s in economics, and led to ideas of markets being allocatively efficient, ideas that governments tend to reduce market efficiency unless there's market failures, that price and value are essentially equivalent concepts. GDP then becomes the main proxy for welfare, and you know, ideas that growth essentially can be infinite. Then next came along a set of more political thinkers, starting really in the kind of post-war period and up into the 70s, who took some of these core ideas and framings and turned them into what we could think of as political memes and norms. The idea that greed is good, that, you know, maximizing pleasure and consumption is moral. A billion acts of selfishness makes a prosperous society. The social duty of business is to maximize its profits and maximize shareholder value. Margaret Thatcher's famous quote again, that markets are efficient, other institutions are not, so markets should be the primary way that we organize society. And the value of something in society is its market price. The idea that because if labor markets are efficient, then you're paid what you're worth to society, and that we have these trade-offs. There's no free lunch. You have to trade off. You can either have more equity and equality and social justice, or you can have more growth. You choose. If you're on the left, you choose one. If you're on the right, you choose the other. And then finally, that the environment exists largely as a resource to be exploited. Again, these are crude characterizations, but you'll probably recognize them from our politics. Now, I would argue that this neoliberal ideology is really just a story to justify power and privilege. And we've had stories in our imagined orders to justify power and privilege going right back as far as we can look. Every imagined order has its stories told by the elite to justify their position. A favorite example is the Code of Hammurabi in ancient Mesopotamia, which laid out why the order of a king, an aristocracy, slaves, and so on, was the just order, the right order for society. It even went down to specifying that the value of a free person was X times more valuable than a slave, and the value of a woman, of course, was much less than a man. And, you know, they even put this into, quite specific categories and amounts. And these arguments always have the same narrative structure, whether it's the Code of Hammurabi or neoliberal ideology today. That the order today is the natural order, the order today is the best order, change will only hurt those it intends to help, and there is no alternative. That's the justification. Now, inevitably, we always appeal to some source of authority for our current order. The old days, it used to primarily be God, so the Code of Hammurabi was handed down by God to the king. Sometimes it was blood and tribe or relations or soil and place, or it's because, you know, history, the ancestors did it this way, so it must be good. Or post-Enlightenment, we start getting appeals to philosophy, science, or to our modern god, economics. The economists say this is right, so therefore it must be the natural order or the best order. Now, just to show you that some more self-aware economists understand that they are storytellers in society, here's a quote from Ariel Rubinstein, a very respected economist at NYU, who says, as in the case of a good fable, a good model can have enormous influence on the real world, not by providing advice or predicting the future, but rather by influencing culture. Yes, I do think we are simply the tellers of fables, but is that not wonderful? Now, let me show you how some of these fables work. So, an example that myself and my co-author have done some work on is the minimum wage. And there, you know, you have a story about, you know, if you raise wages in the market, it's going to be bad for people. It's going to hurt employment. You know, if the price of something goes up, then demand for it goes down, right? Econ 101, raise wages, less jobs, right? So you have, you know, Milton Friedman noting, quoting back in the 60s, that I'm convinced the minimum wage law is the most anti-Negro law in our statute books, in its effect, not its intent. It will only hurt those it's intended to help. This wasn't just an issue in the 60s, so here we have just a few years ago, as there's been a fight in the US to raise the minimum wage to $15, Forbes magazine saying, of course, Black Lives Matter, that's why the $15 minimum wage is a bad idea. Again, the natural order, the current order, is the best order. Changing it will only hurt people. Well, here's the facts, the reality. Been a huge number of studies now showing that basically low-wage employment is unchanged by the minimum wage, jobs aren't lost, but the incomes at the bottom of the distribution are significantly increased, working poverty is generally reduced, dependence on public assistance is reduced, and low-income African Americans have been among the biggest beneficiaries of minimum wage rises. So it's been a story. Now, I think we need some new stories, some new narratives based on more scientific foundations about real human behavior and how real systems work. And I'm hoping that we'll someday look at this quote by John Stuart Mill. It often happens that the universal belief of one age of mankind becomes to a subsequent age so palpable an absurdity that the only difficulty then is to imagine how such a thing can ever have appeared credible. That we will look back on some of the ideas we've had today and see how absurd they are. So let's look at some real science, not armchair anthropology. We're lucky, and there's been terrific work on this here at Oxford. We've had decades of behavioral science across psychology, cognitive science, neuroscience, anthropology, behavioral economics, all kinds of fields, actually looking with real data about how real humans behave. And human sapiens, Homo sapiens look nothing like Homo economicus. So real human decision-making is inductive, it's heuristic, it's modular, it's highly adaptive. Our emotions are not a bug, they are actually a feature. They're very important in helping us navigate the world and social relations and make decisions. And we are highly, highly social creatures. We're among the most social creatures on Earth. We can be selfish, of course, but we are highly, highly groupish. And we tend to be reciprocal in our social relations, highly cooperative, capable of altruism. Our moral intuitions and instincts are a very important shaping force in our decision-making and our social relations. We're also, like all other primates, quite hierarchical, and we also can be tribal, which can have some positive side in being able to organize large-scale activity, but also highly negative side in terms of things like war. We also know a lot more about systems than we did back in the 19th century. And we know that the economy is not an equilibrium system. This is an equilibrium system. It's dead. An equilibrium system is a system without energy flowing in and out of it, without creativity, without novelty, without growth. It just sits there in a state of equilibrium, like the moon here. We now have, really since the 70s, we've had a much better name for what the economy is. It's what many scientists would call a complex adaptive system. It's made up of billions of agents or particles. They interact in networks. They adapt and change over time. There's growth, there's evolution, and there's novelty creation in the system. So rather than thinking of the economy as a system simplistic equilibrium system, we need to think of it in real-world terms as the complex system that it is, that it has all these characteristics of dynamism, nonlinearity, it's self-creating, self-organizing, it's evolutionary, also that energy matters. Economies are powered by energy. They are thermodynamically open systems, and I'll talk about that a bit more in a moment. And they are embedded in other complex systems, the complex systems of human culture and society, and they are embedded deeply in our physical environment. Now, we can use these ideas to start questioning and changing our conception of what economic value is. So we can start, again, with real science and understanding the physical world, that one way to look at the economy, and Don Farmer mentioned this briefly in his talk a couple weeks ago, that we can start with, that we take matter and energy from the Earth, low order, high entropy, and like a metabolism in biology, the economy turns that into higher order, lower entropy products and services. And it does that by taking in, using knowledge from what can be called our physical technologies, such as this laptop or an ox-drawn plow or any other physical items that contain knowledge that we use to organize and build things, and our social technologies, which are our institutions, our ways of organizing people to create order. And just as the laws of physics tell us, such a process of using energy and matter to create order inevitably creates waste. Waste heats, gases, and waste products, which are emitted into the environment. And this then creates value in what my co-author and I call by solving human problems. And so we have created an economic metabolism to convert low order to high order to meet our needs and solve our problems. Now, this is a different conception than thinking of humans as pleasure maximizers or hedonic. That rather one can think of the purpose of the economy is not to just maximize consumption, pleasure, and growth in GDP or output terms. It's not just about more. But rather what the economy does when it does it well is it solves human problems. I have the problem of I need to eat, so I get a meal. I need information, I can get it from this laptop. I need to get from point A to point B. I can take the bus or ride my bike or take an Uber. So we have created a huge variety of solutions to human problems in the economy. And it's when we solve those problems, when you get me from point A to point B, or you get the information you need or the calories that you need, that's what creates value. And our wealth can then be thought of as a stock of solutions to human problems that it gives us more and better ways to solve these problems and meet these needs. We can then think of growth not just as about more stuff, but also is better. Growth is the rate at which we create new and better solutions to human problems and make them available to everyone. An economy where it's only the very richest who get the solutions to their human problems, we would not think of intuitively as a prosperous economy. So how these solutions are made available to people matters. And by solving problems, we create capabilities and enhance agency. If you aren't getting enough food to eat, if you're spending all your time getting from point A to point B, your ability to fulfill your human potential is very limited. So this is building on the ideas of Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum, that a key role of the economy is to create the capabilities and agency for people to fulfill their human potential. And solving complex problems to meet our needs requires cooperation, that prosperous economies facilitate cooperation at scale. And so where this is all leading is a conception of the economy as really being about supporting this, going right back to Aristotle, the idea of eudaimonia or human flourishing. That is the point of the economy, is to support the flourishing of all of us, not just growth in GDP. And so we can think very broadly of a hedonic economy driven by consumption, self-interest, and greed as driving us off the cliff to mass extinction, whereas a reconception of a eudaimonic economy focused on real human flourishing, meeting real human needs, as potentially leading to a more sustainable outcome. So putting some of these ideas together, we can start to see, in rough form, the building blocks for a new thought system. So starting with a moral philosophy built around our pro-social cooperative behaviors and a real scientific understanding of our moral psychology, behavioral theories that look like real Homo sapiens, not these cartoon figures out of earlier centuries. In economic theory, understanding the economy as a complex evolving system embedded in these other systems of society and the planet. And we can start to think of a new economic and political ideology that could emerge out of this that my co-author and I have labeled market humanism, because we do believe that markets continue to be one important social institution, but they need to be harnessed to these human and eudaimonic ends. And we can start to envision a path toward a eudaimonic economy that supports human flourishing. Now, we don't have time to go into the details of all that, but I think when you do run through it, you start to pop out a new set of memes and norms could start being the basis of a new politics. So first, greed is bad. Let's just say it right out. Greed is bad. Maximizing human flourishing is good. Prosperity comes from solving human problems. We solve human problems by cooperating. A billion acts of cooperation makes a prosperous society. Inclusion, fairness, and trust are the foundations of cooperation, and thus they are the foundations of growth. It isn't the big trade-off between social justice and growth. Social justice is essential for growth. The role of government is to foster security and cooperation. Government is not the enemy of this system, it's a key part of the ecosystem, but it's not the whole of the ecosystem, that's for sure. So there is a difference from socialist ideologies here. The role of the markets is to create competitions to cooperate and evolve new and better solutions to human problems. In this conception, markets aren't about efficiency and allocation. They're about creating incentives and competitions to who can be the best cooperators to solve the most human problems. That's what markets are good at when they're well constructed, and that's what they're for. And the social duty of business is not to maximize shareholder value, it's to actually solve human problems. And the moral duty of humankind is to protect the earth. Now, that's all rather philosophical and nice sounding, and you may say, okay, where are the policies? We need policies. If we're going to change the system, we need policies. Well, I would argue we have the policies. We actually have a lot of answers to these big problems, and we, to a large extent, know what policies work and which ones don't. The problem is they haven't been possible. We haven't been able to do them. And the reason why we haven't been able to do them is we haven't had the political space to do them. And part of the reason we haven't had the political space comes back to our Russian dolls. That, the intellectual foundations of our current imagined order give legitimate, through institutions and education have created a set of political narratives and mental frameworks that constrain the political space and the policies in favor of the status quo and against transformation. And so these ideas and policies get shut down. Whereas my argument is, if we shift our thinking, if we change the basis of our imagined order, and we drive that through our education system, through the way we teach courses like economics and other things, and into our institutions, that we have the potential to open up the thinking to broader ideas of transformation, and we will also discover new ideas that we haven't thought of yet, and then we have a shot at actually changing the system. Now, again, you may say that sounds like fantasy, but I have a reason why I think this is possible, because it's happened before, and it happened very recently. There's been some wonderful histories written of the rise of neoliberalism in the US and UK. And what you see is an actually quite explicit effort to do exactly what was on this page, but with a different set of ideas. And they essentially rewired elite thinking, primarily in the US, but to a large extent here as well, over a multi-decade period in a very strategic way through education systems, think tanks, government agencies, training judges, through business schools, all kinds of vehicles. They turned a set of intellectual ideas into a real set of policy and politics that dramatically reshaped the order, not just in those countries, but around the world. So we need to do this again, but with a different set of ideas. Now, my hope, which I'll close with, is that if we do this, that we will change our imagined order, and that imagined order will in turn change the physical and real order of our planet, that the ideas in our heads that we start to organize the economy around start to look more like this than the ones that I showed on the first chart. So I'm going to close with a warning and a bit of optimism.
The warning comes from Isaiah Berlin. Over 100 years ago, the German poet Heine warned the French not to underestimate the power of ideas. Philosophical concepts nurtured in the stillness of a professor's study could destroy a civilization. So all you professors out here with quiet studies, you're very dangerous. But my point is that the ideas nurtured in the stillness of professors' studies hundreds of years ago are still with us today and still driving what we do and how we organize the system, and it's created great dangers for us. Now, finally, on a more optimistic note, we are called, from Buckminster Fuller, we are called to be architects of the future, not its victims. So let's start architecting a new future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eric. We now have time for some questions, and I'm sure there are going to be many. Please just be aware we are filming this and live webcasting it, so only ask a question if you're happy with that. So, Claire, we can take this one in the middle here.
Hi, thank you very much. Two very quick points or questions. One is, how do you feel we seem to be going in the opposite direction now in today's economy from these sort of very sort of sensible ideas to a very strange, chaotic mix? And second, what metrics would you use to suggest that we're on course for this sort of new direction that you're looking for? Because it's easier to measure growth and GDP than solutions to problems. Thank you.
Do you want to take a few questions, or should I?
However you prefer.
Well, since you asked two good ones, I'll do that. But then maybe let lots of people in. We'll take a bunch of them. So first, are we going in the right or wrong direction? It's a very, very mixed story. So, you know, there are reasons to be optimistic. In our group here at Oxford, we've been doing a lot of work on the acceleration of renewable energy sources and you know, understanding the foundations of what a sustainable economy might look like. And you can see how we could get there. And there are probably people in the room who have done actually, you know, quite detailed work on this. You can see the path to get there. But the pessimistic part is we're not doing it. Largely, I believe, because of the things I talked about, our kind of the political box that we work in, the mental frameworks our businesses work in, and all of us. On how would you measure progress in a different way? And I actually think progress is a very good word here, because we're talking about shifting our thinking from being about growth, again, just more, to progress, which is about, can be more sometimes, but it's largely about better, and again, this idea of solving human problems. And we do think you can measure it. There was a famous paper by Nordhaus at Yale back in the 70s that always intrigued me, where he measured how many hours a day do you have to work to get a lumen of light through history. Have some of you seen this chart? It's a fantastic, fantastic chart. But it's a great concept, because a lumen of light is solving a very important human problem, and your ultimate budget constraint is your life. That's the real budget constraint, how many years you have on this planet. And so how much of your life you have to spend to get that lumen of light is a very nice way of actually measuring in a very tangible way the value of a solution to a human problem. And so we're building off of that idea and actually doing some work in our group about how we might measure this. One idea is you can create, just like for inflation measures, we have baskets of consumption goods. You could think of baskets of solutions and measuring, again, you know, how much of a human life do you have to invest to get that.
Okay, there's one here.
Thank you. Thank you. It's for what I found really very uplifting, because I've been so depressed by economics for so many years, and there is now a chance, you've identified it. Do you think that with the increasing awareness of the climate emergency, which will gather speed, I think, as time goes by, the children who are striking are doing a damn good job, but there's other things going on, and as people begin to change their own expenditure, lifestyle, flying, if all the people who fly for the university stopped, this would have an immense impact on the industry and equally in other spheres. But do you think that if we have to deal with that, which I believe we do, this will affect the economy purposefully? Hmm.
Should we take a couple more? Thank you.
Again, I thought your ideas are very good, but will a democracy achieve them?
Easy questions, yeah.
Within the context of the old economic system, when a price was put on sulfur dioxide from combustion of coal, that was very effective in reducing emissions within 30 months. The price of those credits dropped 80%. If we put a price on carbon, we could probably get similar benefits. When people have done that, they've actually reduced them so much that the price fell to almost zero, which was a separate problem. So to what extent do you think the problem is a little bit different, that vested interests have prevented us putting in a price on carbon that would solve a lot of these problems?
Should I take those three? First on the question of, are we, maybe near some tipping point in the climate debate with the young people striking and the growing movements around this. I'm actually hopeful that we are, and I've a little advertising. I've got an article coming out any day now in the U.S. Journal of Democracy on why I think this may be a tipping point and how we can accelerate it. And the core of that is that climate has been argued historically in technocratic terms, again, largely framed by us economists, the same Bill Nordhaus who did the nice light graph also, framed climate as a cost-benefit problem. That's what he got his Nobel Prize for. And that's been very hard to litigate in those terms, because then it's seen as these set of trade-offs, where the young people, Greta Thunberg, has reframed it as a moral question. We, in this generation, are doing harm to them in their generation. That's a moral problem, one group of people doing harm to another group of people. And, we've always talked about future generations in these kind of abstract terms, the climate will hurt future generations. Well, the future generations are here, and they're angry. And that's what the student strike is showing, and we have to respond to that, and they have moral standing. So I think that actually shift to bring into it the moral element of this could be quite transformative. Now, your question then about what do we all do? Of course, we should all do things individually to the extent we can, but we are operating within a system that is geared to make it very hard for us to do that. And so we do need system change. And again, there's many people at Oxford working on what that looks like. But again, my thesis is to get that kind of system change in the time, very limited time that we have, that we have to radically change what's in our heads, and particularly the heads of the elite in policy and political circles, to a different conception of what the economy is about. And again, the neoliberal example showed that can happen relatively quickly. They did that rewiring in about, over the course of 20, 30 years, building off of a crisis they had in the 1970s. Now, your question, can this happen in a democracy? I sure as heck hope so, because if we can't, then none of the alternatives are good. But for it to happen in a democracy, I think we do need these bottom-up social movements, and climate really has to become a mass social movement where politicians lose office and businesses lose money if they're on the wrong side of it. And in this article coming out very soon, I compare the climate movement to the abolition of slavery movement, and what helped that movement become successful and actually turn into a global movement and drive huge change. Now, that leads into finally the question on carbon taxes. As I'd be delighted if we had a high carbon tax today. No one would be more delighted than me. Would it have an effect? Lots of studies suggest it certainly would. Of course, the answer depends on how high. Now, that sets then the political problem is, we've been talking about carbon taxes for many, many decades, and they're still rare, and most of them are still very low, and they've actually abated very few tons of carbon relative to other measures and what we need. And again, it's been framed in technocratic terms. And I think we need to, again, start bringing the moral considerations back into this.
And, you know, in the article, I argue that if you look at the abolition movement, you know, they weren't advocating a slave tax to make slaves more expensive so we'd use less of them. That was not their position. Their position was abolition. We have to stop this. It's a wrong system. We have to stop it. And we're in a very similar situation on climate. The science is very clear. We have to get to net zero by circa 2030 to 2050. That's not very long from now. And net zero is a very strict condition. So we largely, you know, if my friend Miles Allen is here, who works on carbon capture, he'll tell me it's not 100%, but we largely have to abolish carbon in that time frame, not just tax it. So my policy recommendation is carbon should be illegal after a certain date. You laugh.
Clever.
But
there's one
that's here. What we need. Yeah.
Given that the clock is ticking, and given that all the major institutions, governments, commerce, are determined to conserve the status quo because they're doing well out of it and they think it's good, what realistically are the chances of making the kind of changes that need to be made before we're overtaken by global warming and mass extinction and all the rest?
Okay.
David Mendel.
Thank you. There's a little cluster of us in the audience here who come from a background in wildlife conservation.
Yep.
Surprisingly enough, from that very different starting point, we've arrived at remarkably similar logic and conclusions to yourself. But at the very penultimate stage of your futuristic diagram, there was a humanistic market or humanistic economy. Bearing in mind that the very most bottom right-hand output was concern and consideration for all aspects of the earth and its working parts.
Yeah.
How would you react, ungainly as the term may be, to swapping humanistic for non-anthropocentrist?
Yep. Yep.
There's one over there. Okay.
I'll go this one first, sorry.
And we'll come back.
So one core feature of the line of argument you advanced in your presentation is that elites can be this really powerful lever for change. But the two countries which I can claim a personal tie to, India and the US, have elected leaders, you know, precisely because they either are not or do not claim affiliation with elites, right? So how does that affect your line of argument? Because we seem to be seeing that elsewhere as well.
Yeah. I'll first address the question from our wildlife friends. I actually very much agree with you. Part of human progress, or human progress over a long history, has been expanding the moral circle. You know, of where does our moral consideration lie? From kind of immediate family and kin and clan to larger and larger entities. The final step in that is across species. And my final line in here was that preservation of the environment is a moral duty. So while we do need to recouple the economy to serving human needs are intrinsically bound up with the needs of all of our fellow species on the planet. So now I think that expanding of the moral circle is will inevitably take time, but I think it's something that we have to do to get to where we need to go. Now, your question about optimism. If we had 100 years, I'd be pretty optimistic, actually. Human history would give you some reasons to believe that, we can make big changes and have big transformations in our thinking, our intellectual ideas, and our values. But given the time frames we're facing, it's going to be a close-run thing at best, or where we may be cleaning up a lot of messes as we rewire. Sorry, I'm forgetting
It was about elites.
Ah, elites. Yeah, elites who claim they're not part of the elites. Well, don't tell me Donald Trump's not part of the elite. I think that. Elites also doesn't just mean, were you born rich because you may not have been, or you went to the right schools. But you, you know, coming up in any set of political institutions, you become part of that elite as part of that process. And, you know, those institutions, you know, whether they're political parties, civil servants, educational institutions, you know, they have created this bubble of ideas and values that, you know, all of them and all of us have been living in. So, it, you know, there's no single magic bullet answer, but rather a multi-pronged approach. And, you know, we have to start changing the thinking at every, you know, point that touches those elites, whether it's the children out on school strike or, you know, here in Oxford, how we educate our students, or how, you know, in my shop, you know, we're working on policy issues with elite policymakers, you know, from central banks and environment agencies, and try to work through those channels as well. So we have to hit it at all channels.
There's a cluster of hands back over there.
Eric, let me congratulate you on what I think is a spectacular line of thinking. They're just, I agree with most of it. There are just two points I disagree with, and let me just limit that to one. Yeah. I think you're giving the conservative, or you're making your life slightly easy with the conservative, because earlier on in the talk, you seem to argue that the order today is the natural order, and the order today is the best order is really kind of a cynical statement of where we're at. I do believe, though, that the strength of what some of the conservative moral foundations bring to us is the idea that order is really important.
Yeah.
Order for societies is very hard to establish.
Yeah.
And later on in your talk, you then argued that in a modern theory of value, mm-hmm. Order is actually a value, is virtuous. You sort of defined, you know, the economy you'd like to see by being a state of high order and low energy.
Yeah.
So I wondered whether you, perhaps this is just an equivocation and you sort of actually, you know, think sort of, there's order one and order two, or whether you how you see that perceived perhaps incongruity. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. My question relates around how the Chinese model for running the economy fits into those different levels you've described. And after all, they've got 1.4 billion people, which is not a small fraction of human population.
There's one down the front here.
This is to piggyback on the last question, in fact. So much of the solutions, and I'm gonna use this word lightly, are relatively easy for the rich world in the small and shrinking group in the top right of your human flourishing chart. The real problem, a much harder solution, is going to be getting the growing population in the bottom left, the top left, without exploiting the natural resources. How can you envision, even if we manage the rich world to move in the direction you want, how can we really get the developing world where you'd like? Thank you.
Three challenging questions. My colleague Linus asked a very perceptive question about order. And it might surprise you, because you probably thought, oh, this is some, you know, left-wing guy talking about overthrowing capitalism up here. Probably my two of my economic heroes are Adam Smith and Hayek. So that might surprise a few of you. And precisely because of the point that Linus was making. So, societies that have low order are not happy places to live. You know, if you have chaotic social order, and low physical order, you know, that you don't have highly ordered physical objects like this stuff around. That's generally what we think of as poverty. And, you know, so one of Hayek's great insights was, you know, understanding right about how economies create order as an evolutionary system. And what I'm arguing is we need to understand and harness that, again, you know, toward meeting human needs in a way where the energy and thermodynamic and emissions equations work. That's another way of kind of trying to put the problem. And many of the classical economists, you know, in the kind of Burkean Smithian tradition also understood, that social order, and in particular in Smith's case, based on, you know, moral principles and moral reciprocity is a very precious thing. You know, when that breaks down, life is never good, you know. So there is a natural conservatism to this of how do we hang on to, a sense of, material and social order that allows the kind of human flourishing that we want. And that Western societies, those top right countries have delivered on a lot better than, many other societies, but do that in a way that meets the requirements of the planet. That is the core problem. Now, you could then ask, are any other countries doing that? What about China, to your question? Well, this is not, by critiquing modern capitalism, I'm not advocating certainly for communism. This is another point where I'd agree with Hayek. Central planning in an imperfect knowledge environment is not very good at actually solving human problems and meeting human needs and creating fit order. Markets are an essential part of doing that. And, modern China is in kind of a halfway house between those worlds. Some parts of it are the most market-oriented, bits of economy anywhere in the world, and other parts are still very state-controlled. And China recognizes that it is in a unique position. It cannot, there are many economists in China who've been trained at, Wharton and University of Chicago and places like that, and have learned all the standard neoclassical stuff. But then they go back to China and say, well, we can't follow that path. What they used to call the Washington Consensus never worked for China, certainly doesn't work today, that we need to forge a new path of how do you take an economy like that and get it on this track. And the same is true for the developing countries, that there is no model today. That's one of the hardest things. You can't just say, Denmark, let's do that. And there's a whole literature in the development literature about why getting to Denmark is problematic in itself. But even if you could get there, Denmark hasn't solved this problem either. If you look back at that chart, actually the country that was the closest to the left was Vietnam. I don't know if any of you noticed. It's a good question. I need to contact the authors of the study and delve into that a bit. I suspect, it's still a really relatively low emissions economy, not much industry there. But they've made major improvements in the social well-being of their population. But that's probably the hardest thing is there is no model for this. We have to invent a new model. And I do believe that the countries with the most capabilities, the wealthiest, countries like Britain, U.S., Japan, other wealthy countries, and the fast-rising countries in Asia are going to have to be the ones that do this. So again, going back to Buckminster Fuller, we have to be architects of that future. Thank you.
Okay, normally at this juncture, I'm afraid we don't have any more time for questions. There are still various hands. Normally at this juncture, I would tell you what's happening next week. This was the very last lecture of the academic year. There is, in preparation, a whole series on food for next term, so do please check out our website. But I would just like to thank Eric for a really superb talk, and I know that there'll be many people in this room who are eagerly awaiting the book that you said was the source of many of these ideas. But I think all of us will be hoping that the ideas that you've expounded do find their way to the people at the top, the elites, and we wish you every strength in doing that. So thank you very much, Eric.